you were denied the advantages of the other guard. I will rectify that. The energy coalesces into a crackling orb in front of Cedrica's Ra's hand, hovers there for a moment, and then zips towards me. I dive to the side, and the orb alters course, making a beeline for me like it has a mind of its own. I hit the cold floor in a roll and try to avoid the energy, but it's too fast. It burns through the hem of my dress and attaches to my ankle. I scream. The pain is excruciating. It's as if a live wire is being dragged across my skin. I pull my leg in towards me and try to slap at the spot where the orb hit, like I'm on fire and need to pat out the flames. That's when I first see it. The twisting red energy is gone, leaving behind a band of jagged, pink scar tissue around my ankle. It's reminiscent of the angular tattoos I've seen etched on dozens of Mogadorian skulls, but there's also something unsettlingly familiar about it. It's a scar very similar to the ones the guard have signifying the Loric charm. When I look up at Cedrica's Ra, I have to bite my lip to choke off a scream. The bottom half of his pant leg has burned away, an identical charm freshly branded into his own ankle.
"Now," he says, smiling beatifically, "just like them, we are linked."
Chapter 6. I guess in a way, we've kidnapped Dale. He doesn't seem to mind. The scrawny redneck is having a grand old time lounging at the rear of his decades-old pontoon boat, pulling from his flask of moonshine and brazenly ogling me and Marina. This boat of his is literally held together in places by duct tape and shoelaces, and we can't travel through the winding swampland streams too quickly for fear of overheating the engine. Also, every so often, Nine has to use a bucket to scoop dark brown swamp water out of the boat before the footwells collect too much and we sink. Not exactly traveling in style, but Marina remains convinced that Dale stumbled on a Mogadorian encampment, so for now, he's our guide. Last night, Dale insisted it was too dark to try navigating the swamp, but promised he would lead us to this decommissioned NASA base in the morning. It turned out that the bartender at Trapper's rented the shanties surrounding his place to any swamp people passing through. He gave one to us for next to nothing, floated us our meal, too, probably sensing that not helping us would just create more trouble. No one trusted Dale not to run off at his first opportunity, so we decided to take turns keeping watch on him. Nine drew first shift, and ended up sitting with Dale outside our little shack, listening to stories about all the interesting things Dale had scavenged from the swamp. Marina and I lay down side by side on the flea-bitten mattress tossed on the floor of the shack, the only other furnishings, a hot plate, a rusted-out sink that I don't think connected to any pipes, and an oil lantern. Considering we'd spent the last couple of days hiking through the swamps and barely resting, this was about the most comfortable I'd been in days. As we lay there, I noticed that Marina had stopped radiating the aura of cold she'd been giving off since 8 was killed. I thought maybe she'd fallen asleep, but then she started whispering to me in the darkness. "I feel him out there, 6.
"What do you mean?"
I whispered back, not understanding.
8 is...
I hesitated, not able to bring myself to state the obvious.
"I know he's dead," she replied, rolling over to face me. "But I can still feel his... I don't know. His essence or something. He's calling to me. I don't know why or how. I just know it's happening, and that it's important."
I fell silent. I remembered 8's story about meeting a mysterious old man while hiding out in India. I think his name was Devdon.
The old guy taught him about Hinduism and martial arts and eventually disappeared back to wherever he came from. 8 really cherished what he learned about Hinduism. I think it helped him cope with his Sepan's death. Hell, maybe there's something to all that reincarnation stuff. 8 was definitely the spiritual one of us, and if anyone would call out from beyond the grave, it'd probably be him. We'll find him, I say quietly, although I wasn't exactly confident that would be true. I thought about what 9 said during his freakout earlier that night, that we'd already lost the war and no one had told us. I just don't know what we're going to do afterward. It will reveal itself to us when the time comes, Marina replied peacefully, squeezing my hand, the nurturing Marina I'd gotten to know briefly resurfacing, replacing the angry revenge seeker I'd been surviving with the last couple of days. I know it will. So, this morning, we returned to the swamp. The trees are thick on both sides of the murky water, and we frequently have to slow down to navigate around gnarled but ambitious roots that have spread into the water. The canopy of branches over our heads is dense, letting sunlight through in patches. Rotten logs drift by, their bark not always distinguishable from the craggy scales of the alligators roaming these waters. At least the bugs have stopped biting me. Or maybe I've just gotten used to them. Marina stands at the front of the boat, her gaze straight ahead, moisture from the air dampening her face and hair. I stare at her back, wondering if she's lost it, or if this sixth sense about 8's body is another new legacy manifesting. It's at times like these we could really use a Sepan. Marina's having a hell of a time controlling her freezing legacy. 9 and I haven't brought it up with her. He's probably scared she'll bite his head off, and I'm just counting on her learning to control it at the same time she gets a grip on all that anger. So either this return to the swamp is happening because of a potentially haywire new legacy, old-fashioned intuition, grief, or legitimate contact with the spirit world. Maybe a combination of all 4. It doesn't matter, really. We're doing this. It was only a few days ago that 5 led us through waters similar to these. We'd been happier then. I remember Marina and 8 clinging to each other, something sparking there, and 9 whooping and acting stupid every time he spotted an alligator. I run a hand through my hair. It's damp from the humidity and knotted from the days spent out here, and remind myself that this is no time for reminiscing. We're heading into danger, but at least this time we know it. How much farther? I ask Dale. He shrugs. He's gotten a lot more comfortable around us since Marina half-froze his face last night, probably on account of whatever's in that flask. "About an hour," he says. "You better not be screwing with us," I tell him. "If this is bullshit, we'll leave you out here." That makes him sit up a little straighter. "I swear it's true, ma'am. I saw some weird-ass aliens out here, you bet." I glare at him. 9, finished dumping water over the side of the boat, snatches the flask from Dale's hand. "What have you got in here anyway?" 9 asks, sniffing at the flask. "Smells like paint thinner." "I mean, it ain't all paint thinner," Dale counters. "Try some." 9 rolls his eyes and hands him back the flask, then turns to me. "Seriously?" he asks, lowering his voice, more concerned that Marina will overhear than Dale, who's sitting right next to us. "We're relying on this guy?" "Not just him," I reply, shooting a look at Marina. She senses something. "Since when does she..." 9 trails off, for once taking a moment to consider his words. "It still seems a little nuts to me, 6, that's all." Before I can respond, Marina waves her hand at us, getting our attention. "Cut the engine," she hisses. Dale snaps to and turns off the engine, still not wanting to piss off Marina. Our boat drifts forward, silently.
What is it?
I ask.
There's someone up ahead.
I hear it then, too. A motor, one that does a lot less hiccuping than Dale's, getting louder as it moves increasingly closer. With the zigzag pattern this tributary takes through the trees, we can't yet see this other boat. Are there other dirtbag swamp people out this far? Nine asks, eyeballing Dale.
Sometimes, Dale replies.
He looks around at us, as if something has just occurred to him. Now, hold on. Are we in danger? Because I didn't sign up for that.
You didn't sign up for anything, Nine reminds him.
Hush, Marina snaps. Here they come.
I could turn us invisible. It occurs to me to grab hold of Marina and Nine, use my legacy and make it look like Dale's alone out here. But I don't. Marina and Nine don't look like they're in any mood to hold hands, either. If there are Mogadorians out there, we want this fight. I watch a dark outline pass through the clutter of trees and glide into the water in front of us. It's a pontoon boat just like ours, except much sleeker, and probably with a few dozen less leaks. As soon as we come into view, the second boat also cuts its engine. It drifts about 30 yards in front of us, its wake causing us to bob on a gentle wave. The boat is manned by 3 Mogadorians. Because of the heat, they've removed their stupid black leather trench coats and stripped down to tank tops, their arms shining pasty white, their blasters and daggers clearly visible along their belts. I wonder what they're doing out here, brazenly out in the open, and then realize that they're probably looking for us. After all, the swamps are our last known location. These unlucky Moog scouts must have drawn swamp duty. Everyone is very still. We stare at the Moogs, and I wonder if they'll even recognize us in the state we're in. The Moogs stare back, not making any move to restart their boat and get out of our way.
Friends of yours? Dale slurs.
His voice breaks the standoff. In unison, 2 of the Moogs reach for their blasters, the 3rd spinning around to restart their engine. I shove forward with my telekinesis, hitting the front of their boat with as much force as I can muster, causing the ship's bow to rise up from the water. The Moog going for the engine falls overboard, and the other 2 go staggering backwards. A split second after my telekinetic attack, Marina leans over the side and plunges her hand into the swamp water. A sheet of ice spreads out from her towards the Moog's boat, the water cracking and popping as it flash freezes. Their boat is stuck on a tilt, half out of the water, as the ice flow coalesces around it. 9 bounds out of our boat, gracefully runs along Marina's ice flow, and hurdles over the side of the Moog's boat. He grabs the nearest Moog around the neck, his momentum and the boat's sloped deck causing them to stumble towards the boat's rear. The second Moog gets his blaster up and aims at 9. But before he can fire, 9 plants his feet and tosses the first Moog at his buddy. The scout who fell overboard tries to climb out of the water and onto Marina's patch of ice. That's a mistake. A jagged icicle rises from the flow's edge, impaling the Mogadorian. Before that Moog has even turned to ash, I use my telekinesis to tear the icicle through him and send it plunging into one of the Moogs on the boat. The final Moog, dagger drawn, charges at 9. But he grabs the Moog by the wrist, twists backwards, and stabs him through the eye with his own blade. Just like that, it's over. The whole fight lasted less than a minute. Even as dysfunctional as we seem right now,
We can still kill the hell out of some Moogs.
Now that was refreshing! Nine yells, grinning at me from the other boat.
I hear splashing from over my shoulder and turn around just in time to see Dale swimming frantically through the swamp water. He must have jumped overboard, and now he's dog-paddling away from us as fast as his scrawny arms and drunkenness will allow.
Where are you going, idiot? I shout after him.
Dale reaches a muddy outcropping of roots and pulls himself onto it, gasping for breath. He stares at me and the others with wide, wild eyes.
You people are freaks! He screams.
That's not very nice, Nine says, laughing as he carefully makes his way back onto Dale's boat, the ice floe Marina created already beginning to melt in the Florida heat.
What about your boat? I shout to Dale. You gonna swim back to Trapper's?
He squints at me.
I'll figure something out that don't involve mutant powers, thank you very much.
I sigh and raise my hand, intending to telekinetically drag Dale's stupid ass back onto his boat. But Marina touches my shoulder and stops me.
Let him go, she says.
But we need to find the base, I reply.
We're close enough, Marina says, shaking her head. And besides...
Holy shit! Nine interrupts, shielding his eyes and staring up at the sky.
I think we can just follow that thing, Marina finishes. The day suddenly gets very dark. I look up as a shadow passes overhead, cutting off the limited light that was squeezing through the swamp's canopy. Through the leaves, all I can see is the armor-plated hide of a Mogadorian ship as it begins to descend. It's nothing like the dinky saucer-style crafts that I was able to knock out of the sky with a few well-placed lightning bolts. This ship is enormous. The size of an aircraft carrier. Ferocious gun turrets protruding from its belly. The local birds squawk and take flight, darting away from this terrifying giant. Instinctively, I reach out and grab Nine and Marina, turning the three of us invisible. A boat of Mogadorians is one thing. I don't think we're ready for something this big. The warship above us doesn't care, though. It doesn't notice us. To a ship that size, we're as insignificant as the mosquitoes. As it passes, gliding above the swampland and gradually allowing light to re-enter, I feel like I've shrunk. Like I'm small again. Like I'm a child. And then I remember that last day on Lorien. The nine of us and our sepans running for the ship that would take us to Earth. The screams all around us. The heat of fire from the city. Blaster fire hissing through the air. I remember looking up into the night sky and seeing ships just like the one passing over us. Blotting out the stars, their turrets blazing, their cargo doors falling open to let loose hordes of blood-hungry piken. Above us, I realize, is a Mogadorian warship. It's what they will use to take Earth once and for all. They're here, I say, the breath nearly sucked out of me. It's starting.
Chapter 7. Gradually, the suburbs outside Washington, D.C. start to change. The houses become bigger and farther apart, until eventually, they aren't visible from the road at all. Outside the van windows are immaculately maintained meadows or miniature parks where the trees are spaced at obsessively equal intervals, designed to keep the houses behind them hidden from prying eyes. The side streets branching off from the main road all have prestigious-sounding names, like Oaken Crest Way or Gold Tree Boulevard, all of them protected by severe private property signs. In the back seat, Sam whistles. I can't believe they live out here. Like rich people. No kidding, I reply, my hands sweating on the steering wheel. I was thinking the same thing as Sam, but don't really feel like talking about it. Worried that I won't be able to keep the jealousy out of my voice. I've spent my entire life on the run, dreaming about living in places like this. Stable, quiet places. And here are the Moogs, carving out a normal life for their true-born upper class, living the high life on a planet they're only looking to exploit and destroy.
The grass is always greener, Malcolm says.
They do not appreciate it, if that's any consolation, Adam says quietly. The first words he's spoken since we started on these last few miles to Ashwood Estates, his former home. They are taught not to enjoy something unless they can possess it.
What's that mean exactly? Sam asks. Like, if a Mogadorian went to the park?
One takes no satisfaction from that which one cannot hold, Adam recites, suppressing a sneer when he finishes the quotation. That is from Cetricus Ra's great book. A Mogadorian wouldn't care about your park, Sam, not unless the trees were his to chop down.
Sounds like a great book, I say dryly.
I glance over at Adam, next to me in the passenger seat. He's staring out the window, a distant look on his face. I wonder if this is strange for him. It's basically a homecoming, even though he's not actually from Earth.
Adam turns his head, notices me looking at him, and seems almost embarrassed. His expression quickly changes to one I'm familiar with. Cold, Mogadorian composure.
Pull over here, he instructs. It's only a mile farther on.
I pull the van over to the side of the road and kill the engine. Without the noise from the van, the constant chirping from behind me seems even louder.
Geez, guys, calm down, Sam says to the box of excited Chimeri sitting on the bench between him and Malcolm.
I turn around to look down at the Chimeri, all of them in bird form. Regal, whose resting form is a stately hawk, perches next to a trio of more common birds, a pigeon, a dove, and a robin. Then there's a sleek gray falcon that must be Dust, and an overweight owl that has to be Stanley. All of them have lightweight leather collars strapped gently around their necks. This is step one of our plan.
Is everything working? I ask Sam, who looks up from the laptop resting on his legs and grins at me.
Check it out, Sam says proudly, turning the laptop to face me.
Using the Chimeri in this way was his idea. Tiled on the laptop screen are half a dozen grainy video feeds, each of them showing my face from a slightly different angle. The cameras are working. On our way from Baltimore to Washington, we stopped at a dark little storefront called Spy Guys that specializes in cameras and home security gear. The clerk didn't ask Malcolm why he needed to purchase more than a dozen of their smallest wireless cameras. He seemed grateful for the business and even showed us how to install the necessary software on one of our laptops. After that, we picked up the collars at a pet store. The others carefully attached the cameras to them while I drove south towards Washington. The Mogadorians have spent so much effort running surveillance on us, stalking us. Now, we're going to turn the tables.
Spread out around Ashwood Estates, I tell the Chimeri, punctuating my command with a mental picture of the satellite photos of Ashwood that I've been studying since yesterday, and sending that onto the flock telepathically. Try to cover every angle. Focus especially on where the Mogadorians are. The Chimeri respond with enthusiastic cawing and a fluttering of wings. I nod to Sam, and he throws open the van's side door. What follows is a wild flurry of activity. Our half-dozen shape-shifting spy birds taking off all at once. A funnel of squawking and flapping wings as they fly out of the van. As serious as our situation is, there's something awesome about the sight. Sam is grinning, and even Adam allows himself a small smile.
This is going to work, Malcolm says, patting Sam on the back. Sam's smile increases just a little bit more.
The view on the laptop screen is disorienting. The Chimeri all swooping and gliding in different directions. The first to settle into some trees position themselves right above the wrought iron gates of Ashwood Estates. A gate is built into a brick wall there. The wall stretches for a few yards and then, presumably once it's no longer visible from the road, turns into a more sinister-looking barbed wire fence.
Guards, I say, pointing out the trio of Mogadorians, two of them sitting in the gatehouse, one of them pacing in front of the gate itself.
That's it? Sam asks. Only three of them? That's nothing.
They do not expect a frontal attack, or any attack, really, Adam explains. Their purpose is mainly to scare off any drivers who might make a wrong turn.
As the remaining Chimeri settle under rooftops and tree branches, the video feeds snapping into focus, I start to get a clearer idea of Ashwood Estates' layout. Beyond the front gate is a short but winding entrance road with very little cover. That road leads to what is essentially a very large cul-de-sac. About 20 well-appointed houses arranged around a central recreation area. Apparently the Mogadorians have picnic tables, basketball hoops, and a pool. All in all, it's an idyllic swath of suburbia. Except there's no one around.
Seems quiet, I say, scanning the feeds. Is it always like this?
No, Adam admits. Something isn't right.
One of the Chimeri takes flight and repositions itself, getting an angle on one of the houses that we couldn't see before. A trash truck is parked at the curb, its engine off.
There's someone, Sam says, enlarging the feed.
A solitary Mogadorian holding a tablet computer stands next to the truck. He looks bored as he thumbs something into the tablet.
Adam squints at the tattoos on the Mogadorian's scalp.
An engineer, he says.
You can tell that? I ask.
It's in the tattoos. For Trueborn, those are symbols of honor and what they've accomplished. The Vatborn get job titles, Adam explains. Makes it easy to order them around.
There's more, Sam points out.
We watch as four Mogadorian warriors carry a refrigerator-sized piece of computer equipment out of the house. They take it towards the curb and set it down in front of the engineer, then wait around while he circles the machine and inspects it.
Looks like a server,
Malcolm observes. He turns to Adam.
Could they be replacing the equipment you destroyed?
Possibly,
Adam replies. But he doesn't sound certain. He points out a two-level house with a porch a few doors down from where the Mogadorians are working.
That's my old home. I know for certain there's an access point to the tunnels through there. But the other houses likely have access, too.
While Adam's talking, the engineer finishes his inspection of the server. He shakes his head, and the other Mogs pick the equipment back up. They toss it into the trash truck, then return to the house.
I guess they aren't big on recycling, huh? Sam says.
Before the first group of Mogs can head back into the house, a second group emerges. They're carrying what looks like a barber's chair from a bad sci-fi movie. The thing, equal parts futuristic and frightening. Wires and nodes dangling from it. The engineer hustles forward to meet this second group, helping them to ease the equipment gently onto the grass of the front yard.
I recognize that,
Malcolm says, an edge to his voice.
Dr. Anu's machine,
Adam says, turning to me.
That's what they used on Malcolm. And on me.
What are they going to do with it now? I ask. Watching the engineer begin his inspection.
This looks like a salvage team, Adam explains. I did some damage to the tunnels the last time I was here. Now they're saving what equipment they can and getting rid of the rest.
What about all the Trueborns who are supposed to be here? Adam grimaces.
They might have been evacuated until this place can be brought up to spec.
I widen my eyes at Adam. So we drove out here for nothing? The Trueborn are already gone and the machine is busted?
No,
he says, and I can see the gears turning behind his eyes.
If we can take out this salvage team before they get off a distress call, we'd have complete access to what's left of Ashwood. From there, we can get onto their network.
And that gets us what?
It's like if one of my people could open one of your chests, John. We'll know their secrets, what they're planning.
We'll be one step ahead, I say.
Yes.
Adam nods, watching the engineer as he evaluates Dr. Anu's machine.
But we should get in there. What the salvage team decides to destroy could still be useful to us.
All right, I say, watching the Moog salvage team head back into the house. So is there a secret entrance or something?
At this point, I think a direct assault is our best bet.
He looks at me.
That all right with you?
Hell yes, I reply. Originally, we'd planned to use our network of Chimeri surveillance to observe the Moogs for a while, figure out the most strategic approach to attacking. But now that we're here, I find myself itching to go into battle. I need some payback for everything they've done, for taking Ella, destroying Nine's home, killing one of my friends. If Adam says we need to rush in, I'm ready to go. Malcolm grabs a box from under the seat. From within, he produces two earbuds, one for me and one for Adam. The devices are connected to the pair of walkie-talkies Sam and Malcolm will be using. I slip mine into my ear and Adam does the same.
Are we at all concerned with the local authorities? Malcolm asks. A firefight in broad daylight might attract some attention.
Adam shakes his head.
They're bought off,
he says, then looks at me.
We will want to be quick, though. Kill them before they can call for reinforcements. If I can get past them into my old house, I should be able to cut off their communications.
I can do quick, I reply. I strap my Lorik dagger to my calf, hidden under my pant leg. Next, I clip my red bracelet around my wrist, the amber jewel in its center that expands to form a shield shimmers in the midday sun. Immediately, the bracelet jolts me with icy pinpricks, warning me there are Moogs in the area. Of course it would. There's one sitting right next to me. Adam's presence is going to really wreak havoc on my danger sense. Ready? I ask him. Next to me, Adam pulls on an over-the-shoulder holster, a silenced handgun now hanging under each of his armpits. He nods.
Whoa, hold on, Sam says. Check out this guy.
Adam and I turn back to the laptop, watching as another Mogadorian emerges from the house the salvage team is currently unloading. He's tall and broad-shouldered, bigger than the others, and with a more regal bearing. Unlike the others, he has a huge sword strapped across his back. While we watch, he barks some orders at the engineer, then disappears back into the house. When I glance over at Adam, his face is somehow more pale than usual. What is it?
Nothing,
he says, too quickly.
Just watch out for that one. He's a Trueborn general, one of Cetricus Ra's most trusted men.
Adam hesitates, watching the spot on the monitor this general just occupied.
He has killed guard before.
I feel heat rushing to my hands,
If I wasn't ready for a fight already, I definitely am now. He's dead, I say, and Adam merely nods, opens his door, and gets out of the van. I look to Sam and Malcolm. We'll approach on foot, take out the guards, and then you pull up to cover our back.
I know, Sam says. I'll watch the monitor and shout in your ear when I see trouble.
Malcolm has already started unpacking his sniper rifle from its case. I saw him use that thing in Arkansas. He saved my ass. There's no one I'd rather have watching my back than the goods.
Be careful, Malcolm says, raising his voice so Adam can hear. Both of you.
Sam and I slap hands.
Give them hell, he says.
And then I'm out of the van, moving at a brisk jog towards the Mogadorian stronghold. Adam keeps up alongside me.
John,
he says, our feet crunching in the gravel on the side of the road.
There is something else you should know.
Of course. Just when I was beginning to let my guard down around this guy, right when we're going into battle together, he's going to spring something on me.
What is it?
The general is my father.
Chapter 8. I almost skid to a stop, but Adam doesn't seem to be slowing down any, so I keep pace with him. You're kidding me.
No,
Adam frowns, focusing on the road ahead.
We don't exactly get along.
Are you going to... I don't even know how to phrase this. Will you be able to...
Fight? Kill?
Adam replies.
Yes. Show him no mercy because he won't show any to us.
Your own father. Man. I mean, even for a Mogadorian, that's pretty cold.
At this point, defeating him in battle is likely the only way he'll ever feel pride for me,
Adam replies, adding weakly,
Not that I care.
I shake my head.
You guys are so screwed up.
We fall silent as the entrance to Ashwood Estates comes into view. The Mogadorian in front of the gates spots us and shields his eyes from the sun, trying to get a better look. We keep up a steady pace and don't make any attempt to conceal ourselves. We're separated from the gates by about 50 yards and closing fast. But to the Moog, we might look like just a couple of joggers. He won't notice the gun strapped to Adam just yet.
Wait until we're a little closer,
I say through gritted teeth, and Adam nods. At 30 yards, the Moog turns his head, saying something to his two buddies in the gatehouse, warning them that something might be up. I see them stand up, silhouetted in the window, peering out at us. The Moog in the front edges back a bit, his fingers inching towards the blaster, surely hidden under his coat. But he hesitates. Probably still thinks he's being paranoid. They really never thought we'd come for them. They aren't prepared. With 20 yards to go, I fire up my lumen, flames roaring across my hands. Next to me, in stride, Adam draws both his guns and takes aim. The closest Moog tries to pull his blaster, but he's way too slow. Adam fires 2 shots, one from each gun, both of them muffled by silencers. Struck twice in the chest, the Moog teeters for a moment, and then explodes into a cloud of ash. I launch a fireball at the gatehouse. The Mogadorians inside are scrambling around, but, like their friend, are also too slow. The fireball explodes through the window, sending glass everywhere, and causing one of the Moogs to go up in flames. The other one manages to throw himself out the door, flames dancing up his back. He's standing right in front of Ashwood's locked entrance, so I reach out with my telekinesis and tear the wrought iron gate off its hinges, crushing the Moog. Think the others heard us? I ask Adam as we step around the bent metal gate and into Ashwood Estates.
Our entrance did lack subtlety, Adam observes.
Sam's voice crackles in my ear. Four of them, running up the access road, Sam warns. Blasters ready. The access road is uphill with a slight bend at the top, after which we'll be at the housing development. There isn't a whole lot of cover on the way. Stay behind me, I tell Adam. Just then, the Moogs come around the bend. They don't ask any questions before unleashing a volley of blaster fire. Adam leaps behind me just as my shield deploys. It's like a parachute exploding out of my arm. The rippling crimson material spreading to absorb the blasts. Adam grabs hold of the back of my shirt.
Go forward, he says.
I do. The shield absorbing more blaster fire as I press towards the Moogs. The bracelet is now a steady, numbingly painful buzz against my wrist. Carefully following my steps to keep from getting shot, Adam pops around the edge of the shield, gunning down two of the Moogs in one go. Realizing they're not making any progress, the other two try to retreat. I lower my shield and launch a fireball that explodes between them, knocking them both to the ground. Adam finishes them off with some well-aimed gunfire. Out of danger for now. My shield retracts back into my bracelet. Not bad, I tell him.
We're just getting started, he replies.
We run down the access road around the bend, and the opulent homes of Ashwood Estates finally come into view. There's no one out, and all the windows are dark. The whole place feels like a ghost town. To our right, I see Adam's old house, and a few houses down from that is the trash truck, and the high-tech chair the engineer was inspecting. The salvage teams, the engineer, and the general are nowhere to be seen.
They're coming from the backyard, Sam yells.
Both Adam and I spin around in time to see a squadron of Moog warriors sneaking towards us between two of the houses. It would have been a pretty good ambush if we didn't have scouts perched in their trees. As they raise their blasters, Adam is ready. He stomps the ground, and a concussive wave of force rolls in their direction, pavement and chunks of grass rippling upward. The closest Moogs are completely thrown off their feet. Others stagger, and one of them accidentally discharges his blaster into another's back.
I'll finish them off, I tell Adam.
You go make sure they aren't calling reinforcements. Adam nods, then sprints across the lawn towards his old house. Meanwhile, next to the stunned Mogadorians, I notice a metal tank that came unmoored from where it was attached to a house. With my hearing focused, I can hear a faint hiss emanating from the tank. I almost laugh at my luck. It's a gas line. I launch a fireball at the Moogs before they can collect themselves. It whizzes right by the lead Moog, who I think actually smirks at me, thinking that I missed in those 2 seconds before the propane tank explodes, incinerating the lot of them. The windows of the two adjacent houses are all blown inward from the force, large black singe marks forming on the outside, grass burning. I have to stop myself from appreciating the destruction. It feels almost cathartic to destroy this place, to tear down what the Moogs have built after how many times they've torn down my attempts at a normal life.
Damn, dude, Sam says in my ear. We felt that over here.
I yank my walkie-talkie off the back of my jeans.
What's it look like, Sam?
You're clear, he says. It's weird. I thought there'd be more of them.
They could be down in the tunnels, I reply, starting towards the house Adam rushed into. I scan the empty windows as I go, wary of any Moogs who might be lying in wait.
It's just too damn quiet. And that huge-ass general guy, Sam says, he wasn't with the ones you blew up.
I'm crossing the lawn towards Adam's house when the front window shatters and Adam's body comes flying out. His legs smack hard against the porch railing, and he's turned head over heels, flipped like a rag doll into the front yard. I run to him as he shakily tries to pick himself up. "What happened?" I shout.
"Father isn't happy," he groans,
looking up at me as I crouch down over him. There's a huge piece of glass sticking out of his cheek, a trickle of dark blood running down his neck. He yanks it out and tosses it aside.
"Can you get up?"
I ask, grabbing his shoulder. Before Adam can answer, a booming voice interrupts.
"Number 4.
The general strides confidently through the front door, looking down at me from the porch. He's huge and muscular. The tattoos splashed across his pale skull are way more intricate than any Moog I've seen outside of Cetricus Ra. I sense motion behind him. Other Moogadorians. I can't be sure how many. They don't come out of the house. It's almost like the general wants to do this alone. I stand up and face him, my hands glowing and hot, a fireball floating in my palm. "You know who I am, huh?" I ask him.
"Indeed. I have long hoped we would meet."
"Uh-huh. If you know me, then you know you don't stand a chance against me." I crane my neck to look past him. "None of you do." The general actually smiles.
"Very good. Bravado. A welcome change of pace. The last Lorik I encountered ran. I had to stab him in the back."
I decide I've had enough talk, and whip the fireball at him. The general sees it coming, hunkers low, and in one surprisingly fluid motion, draws his sword from its sheath. He slices the air in front of him just as the fireball gets close, and the glowing Moogadorian blade absorbs my attack. Not good. The general leaps off the porch, sword raised above his head, and brings it down in a vicious arc towards me. He's fast. Way faster than the other Moogs I've been fighting. And my shield barely has time to deploy before his sword would cleave me in two. The shield rebuffs the blade with a loud clang, but the force is still enough to knock me backwards and off my feet.
"John!"
Adam shouts, and the general, having landed right next to him, takes a moment to kick his son hard across the face. Adam screams, rolling away.
"You are a perpetual disappointment," the general seethes at Adam, so low I can barely hear his words. "Stay down, and I may yet show you mercy."
I pop onto my knees quickly, channeling another fireball. The general points his sword at me, and I feel something like a rush of air, almost like the blade is sucking in the energy around it. My fireball gutters and shrinks, forcing me to focus harder to build it bigger. Meanwhile, the grass around the general goes from green to brown, the blade draining the life from it. I haven't seen one of the Moogs armed with a weapon like this since the fight in the woods outside Paradise High.
"Don't let it hit you,"
Adam warns, spitting blood. But his warning is too late. A dagger-shaped bolt of energy tears loose from the general's blade and screams towards me. The energy is black, or more like devoid of any color at all, and changes the very texture of the air that it passes through, sucking up life and oxygen like a mini black hole. I don't have a chance to dodge it. My shield deploys, expanding in the usual umbrella-like way, but immediately turns black and brittle when the general's blast hits it. Frozen like that, my shield slowly begins to crumble, blown away like so much Moogadorian ash. Dark, rust-like veins begin to spread through the bracelet itself, and I hurriedly snap it off before they make contact with my skin. When it hits the ground, my bracelet breaks in half. The general smiles at me again and asks,
"Now will you run?"
Chapter 9. The Moogadorians who were taking cover inside the house start to laugh. One by one they filter onto the porch, eager to get a closer look as their great general dispatches one of the guard. There's a couple dozen of them,
The salvage team, plus some warriors and scouts. All of them Vatborn. Not exactly the high-priority targets we were hoping for, but that doesn't matter now. There are only two Trueborn Moogs in Ashwood Estates. One of them is Adam, and he's laid out in the grass just a few yards from me, dark blood dripping from his face. The other is charging right at me. As the general bears down on me, sword leveled at my throat, there's a moment where I think we might have bitten off more than we can chew. Adam and me trying to take on an entire Mogadorian town. But then I remember, it isn't just the two of us. With a shriek, Dust, still in falcon form, dive-bombs the general. His talons sink deep into the general's face, the huge Mogadorian grunting in pain before he manages to backhand Dust away. It's exactly the distraction I need. Quickly, I form another fireball and pitch it at the general. This time, he doesn't have a chance to get his sword up, and the fire hits him right in the chest. I expect him to at least be knocked off his feet. But the general merely stumbles back a few steps. The front of his uniform burns away, revealing a carapace of obsidian Mogadorian armor beneath. Dust, stunned by the blow, flops into the grass at the general's feet. He brings his sword down hard at the chimera, but Dust transforms into a snake at the last second and manages to slither through the grass away from the blade. The general, fresh claw marks across his face, swings his gaze back to me.
"Hiding behind your pets," the general bellows. "Disgraceful. Fight me with honor, boy. No more tricks."
I hold up my hand and smile at the general, noticing the birds fluttering in from all sides. "Hold on. Just one more trick." And that's when the rhinoceros drops from the sky. One moment the chimera, I'm not even sure which one, is a robin flying innocently above the heads of the Mogadorians. The next, it's a half-ton African rhino belly-flopping on top of them. A couple of the Moogs on the porch are crushed outright, the wood breaking and splintering, the front of the house even sinking a little at the beast's weight. Another Moog is gored by the rhino as it starts to rampage around. The other Moogs spill into the yard, blasters firing. They aren't laughing anymore. This whole noble execution the general had them watching has been ruined by our small army of Chimerae. It's chaos. All around us, birds are morphing into more lethal forms. A bear, a couple of jungle cats, and a lumbering lizard thing that I think is a Komodo dragon. And running down the Mogadorians. I see some of the Chimerae sustain blaster burns as the Moogs fire madly at them, trying desperately to regroup. They won't be able to hold out long. For once, we've got the element of surprise. "Looks like you should be the one running," I yell at the general as I square up with him. Truth be told, I'm not sure what to do with him. He is Adam's father, after all. Adam told me to show no mercy, but it still feels wrong to kill a father in front of his son, even if they are Mogadorians. I glance over to Adam, hoping he'll at least give me a thumbs up or thumbs down, but he's still crumpled in the grass, struggling to pick himself up. Dust is next to him in wolf form, also looking a little beaten up, gently licking Adam's face.
"My name is already written in the histories as a killer of God,"
the general roars back at me, not even caring about the decimation of his men going on behind him.
"If today is the day I die, I will take you with me."
He charges me, sword stabbing right for my sternum. I hold up my arm, expecting my shield to deploy and deflect the blow. It takes me a split second to remember my wrist is bare, my shield destroyed. The general almost skewers me for my over-reliance on my bracelet. I have to spin to the side at the last second and can feel how close I came, his blade tearing through the back of my shirt. The general's sword might miss, but his elbow doesn't. Using his momentum to swing around, he catches me right in the temple. He must be wearing that Mogadorian armor all over his body, because the elbow feels more like a hammer. I stumble to the side, seeing stars. The general slashes at me again, and I just barely manage to lash out with my telekinesis, shoving him backwards. His heels dig up tufts in the grass as he refuses to leave his feet. Instead of charging back at me, the general levels his sword, another mini vortex developing at the blade's tip. I'm caught out. No shield, no cover, and I know I can't let that life-draining energy hit me. I brace myself, ready to dive aside. Before the sword can discharge, the general's right hand explodes. He roars and drops his blade, holding up his hand to look at the nickel-sized hole through the palm that wasn't there a second ago. "Dad says you're welcome," Sam's voice chirps in my ear. I glance over my shoulder to see our van parked on the access road. Malcolm Goods stands next to the driver's side door, using it for cover, as he peers through the scope of his rifle.
"Interlopers," the general growls.
Before Malcolm can fire another shot, the general takes off at a sprint, using the trash truck for cover. He's surprisingly fast, considering his bulk and that full suit of armor. Well, I'd wanted him to run. I chase after him, thoughts of how he hunted and killed guard fueling me. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a Moog warrior draw a bead on me with his blaster. As he fires, a chimera in the shape of a black panther leaps onto his back. The blast sails wide and ends up shearing in half the chair Dr. Anu used in his experiments. I know our goal was to keep this Moog technology intact. That doesn't matter to me now. I'm seeing red. The general, so proud of killing guard. Killing children. I'm going to write the last chapter in his precious history right now. As I come around the trash truck, I see the general has made it onto the basketball courts and stopped. He beckons me onward, waiting for me at center court. I charge in, ignoring the part of me that knows he's setting me up for some kind of trap. Whatever it is, it won't stop me. The general growls something in Mogadorian. It sounds like a command. Under my feet, beneath the asphalt, a generator of some kind vibrates to life. I feel a static charge as a dome-shaped force field rises up over the basketball court, trapping me with the general. Everything is suddenly very quiet. The noise of the chimera mauling the Mogadorians blocked out by the force field. I take a step away from the nearest wall, sensing the same type of electric jolt that we encountered at the base in West Virginia. I remember how sick I was after that. It took me days to recover, and know that I can't get that close. Even as I'm thinking this, an overeager chimera in the shape of a tiger flings herself at the general. The blue energy repulses the pouncing chimera, shocks her, and leaves her in a convulsing heap on the ground. Still very much outside the force field.
"We used to fight pikemen against each other in this place,"
the general muses, waving his hand at the enclosed space.
"It was a reward for the Vatborn. Pity more of them aren't here to witness today's contest."
"You want some alone time with me? Is that it?" I taunt the general, making sure to put some distance between me and the force field.
"I want to kill you in peace," he replies, "with your many friends watching helplessly."
Good luck with that. Without hesitation, I charge towards the general, pitching fireballs at him as I go. He absorbs each of them. Huge chunks of his uniform burn away. But I don't seem to be doing any damage to the armor underneath. Not letting any pain register on his face, the general rushes right for me, like he's going to barrel into me.
He probably weighs a solid 200 pounds more than me with that armor. But screw it. We crash together and the wind goes out of me, but I manage to stay upright.